and welcome to this week's podcast. I'm Andrew Teacher, Senior Advisor to Montford, and we're joined this week by the inimitable Ryan Prince, who's the Vice Chairman of Real Star Group and founder at Uncle, and Dr. Anna Minson, who's a reader in architecture at the University of East London. She's also the author of the book Big Capital, Who is London For?, which is out now on Penguin via all good bookstores. Great to see you both. Dr. Anna Minson. Anna, I swore to you actually that we'd met previously, and I think we had. You didn't remember, which I've forgiven you for. But we met again in January at quite a posh lunch in the centre of town, and we were talking about your new book. You were giving me a bit of a sneak preview, and you asked me at that lunch, can I introduce you to any people in private equity, real estate, any people, any major big ticket private investors who can give you a bit of background off the record on the housing market. And I've gone one better than that. I haven't only introduced you to one of the best people to speak to, one of the most intellectually informed and just generally savvy players in the market, but you're doing it on the record, on tape, on podcast. How's that? Never let it be said that I don't deliver what I say I'm going to deliver. So what would you like to understand from Ryan, who has been building up the European arm of Real Star for nearly 10 years. They've made some amazing headway in the market, largely through Uncle, their build-to-rent strategy and integrated platform. But what's the big, big question you've got for Ryan and some of his peer group right now, Anna?
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for having me on the podcast. And thank you very much for introducing me to an investor. That was my request to you. And I must admit, it's been quite difficult to speak to private investors. It's been quite difficult to speak to the private equity real estate industry.
It's like because they're all off skiing.
I'll be honest with you. I don't think they're that keen to talk to me, probably because they think I'm going to be critical, or perhaps because they think I'm unlikely to be giving them sufficiently good PR to make it worth their while to have a conversation. But really what I'm hoping to do is to sit alongside people from within the property industry to allow all actors, all sides of the debate, to be able to sort of give their sides of the story so that we can actually come to a proper in-depth analysis of this really extreme situation that we find ourselves in, not just in London, but in cities all around the world with regard to the global housing crisis, which is what my new book is focusing on. So I'm actually really grateful for the opportunity. In terms of what questions might I have specifically for Ryan, who, you know, it's really not my job here to be critical of Ryan's business. Ryan seems to run an eminently successful property brand. But I suppose what I'm interested in is, from your perspective, and you may not think this is actually something that your business should concern itself with, you're there to provide a sound investment proposition for your business. But how would you sort of position what you do in relationship to the housing crisis, particularly affordability, property price inflation in the centre of cities? Some might say that some of the schemes that you're involved with are not really on the affordable side. Those sorts of questions I think I'd be interested in finding more about.
Sure. Well, I guess I'd start by saying thanks, Andrew, for having me. I'm getting old. We actually are just about to come up to our 22nd anniversary here. So if I'm around longer than I was thinking it, maybe it would be. And I think to address your point on housing, I think housing is an enormous topic, as you know much better than me. You are, after all, the doctor in the room. And I think my starting point, and I've said this before, is the housing crisis is not a UK-only problem. And I think that that's often forgotten in the way that we read about it. Brexit is a UK-only problem. That was homegrown. That's our own particular self-creation. Housing isn't. Wherever you really choose to look, I'm Canadian by background. I grew up in Toronto. Canada and Toronto has a massive housing crisis. Parts of the US, depending on who you ask, have real shortages. You look in Hong Kong, you look in Paris. And the theme, I think, for housing crises is where there are cities that are thriving and where there are jobs and people want to be, tends to be there's a shortage of little or capital A affordable housing. And I think that's a theme. And I think, moreover, I can't point to one place in the world that solved the problem. So I think it's important anytime anyone's having a conversation about it, we start from a place that says, you know, I'm a not invented here person. I love to look around the world and look in other places as to who's solving problems that have already been solved. And nobody from where I sit has solved the issue of what everybody wants. What does everybody want? If you think about, you know, food, shelter, and healthcare, people want to live in reasonable size homes that are beautifully designed, that they can afford, and you could have a definition of what that looks like. And the reality is that distribution doesn't really work. When you bring things more close to home in the UK, I think there's some particular reasons for that that are UK-centric. And I will come back to your question on us and our strategy and what we're doing and our views on our obligations in the space. But I think you have to think about what's the context of what's created that. I think the largest factor really is the government, and Andrew and I were talking about this in an article that came out recently in the Times property section. Historically, where you look at housing supply is a twofold thing, private suppliers and public suppliers. And in the last 30 years, you have no public suppliers of housing. So the biggest shortcoming of housing compounded over the last number of decades is government-controlled house builders, whether you call those councils or whichever quango form you'd like, that no longer exist, produces zero housing. And then I think a whole variety of other factors that have led to a massive shortage of small to medium-sized businesses who also provide housing. So when you look today, there's 5 to 10 names who probably provide, and I don't know the number off the top of my tongue, but the majority of housing in the UK that's then augmented by local authorities, the larger ones in particular, the Peabodys of the world, the LNQs of the world, and that's the whole story. And that's a very, very different story than it was 40 or 50 years ago. You can then build on that and look at what are the impediments to creating supply, and there's a variety of answers.
I think it's a fair point. And, you know, to your question, Anna, it's something similar that's been thrown at me many, many times in meetings like this and TV interviews that I've done, radio debates over the years with a lot of the businesses that I personally have worked for since I set up Blackstock back in 2012. You know, everyone from M&G, Granger, Moda Living, Essential Living, firms that I played an outsized role in supporting. And the big challenge is always, you know, why are you refurbishing this ghastly tower and archway to build flats that are going to rent for £50 a foot? And the straightforward answer is, well, you'd rather have expensive, nicely designed flats here than an empty building that's basically blighting a chunky corner in North London. And I think you're right to point out that need around affordable housing. But I think it is, as Ryan says, it's about distribution in the same respect as there are millions of people going hungry, but the US probably throws away 40, 50% of all the food it grows. There was some stat I saw the other day to that effect. And I think it's a similar point where if all of that stuff that's thrown away was used, lots of people wouldn't be hungry. And similarly, if there was an adequate spreading of tax subsidies, you know, let's just take one of the stupid policies we've seen over the last few years, Help to Buy. If some of that money spent on subsidizing the shareholders and investors of volume house builders, some of that money was spent just on the straight up provision of social housing, it'd be a much smaller problem to deal with in this country. So I think, you know, there are a number of things, and it's impossible to disentangle all of them, but I think that there are a number of things that we could probably move with. I mean, Ryan mentioned there just an article run recently in the Sunday Times by David Byers, who's a good contact of many of us. He's one of the UK's journalists that's written most about the build-to-rent sphere over the years. And I saw him last week, and actually we were joking about a walk around we did down in Hove years ago on the Moda scheme down there. And the article that David wrote that Ryan was interviewed for was looking at the challenges that NIMBYism throws up against property development. And it's really, really evident with this sector just because it's misunderstood. A lot of the guidance is ignored. Guidance exists nationally, but not always locally. And it's a good microcosm of problems within the planning system, whereby you have these sort of national, regional, and local layers, none of which talk to each other, none of which align. And then you throw in the sweet juice of party politics. And that sort of leads us to where we are. I mean, in terms of, I suppose, your vantage point, Anna, how do you see that? How do you see the policy lens? And does everything simply come down to price?
Well, that's actually not a straightforward question, because why are we in this affordability crisis to start off with. But first of all, just to say, I think I agree very much with what both of you have already outlined about the broad context behind why we are where we are today. But just to add to Ryan's point about a small number of key players, well, you know, you mentioned the Peabodys of this world, the housing associations who are in charge of providing affordable housing, but they're really not doing it. I mean, obviously, at the same time, we've got a very small number of leading house builders who are responsible for providing for sale housing, and they're not really doing it either at the rate that they should. And we constantly
Let me just interrupt you. I mean, you use words like responsible and should, but I think
language is really important.
Because in government terms, governments always say, well, we're going to deliver 300,000 homes or we're going to deliver 1.5 million homes.
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head. When I say responsible and should, I'm talking about the narrative. Mm. And that narrative is a government-led narrative.
Because their shareholders would say the market's a bit screwy. I said, don't build anything.
Well, you're completely right. It's not the house builder's narrative. And I think in the public mind, there isn't that differentiation there. Actually, the house builder's narrative is the market-led narrative. And it very often does not suit them to produce the homes that government says they're going to produce. So the story isn't being told properly. But the fact is, those homes are not being produced. And policy seems to be completely paralysed as to why for sale housing isn't being produced. But it's also completely paralysed as to why affordable and social housing isn't being produced. So you've got both of these aspects of policy which seem completely unable to move forwards. And I feel that it's a challenge that government in this country has decided it's too big to take on. So they just do these small little fixes and throw out these small little policies here and there. But actually, they're unable to really deal with the systemic problem.
Mm. And I guess the other point from a build-to-rent perspective is provision of rental housing, because again, that it's not even on the table. At least there are sort of random throwaway policies to placate people, whether it's around house building for owners or house building for people that require subsidised rents. But there's nothing at all on the private rental sector. And it feels like we might be at a tipping point there. So this is a point you made at the lunch, really, wasn't it? Around the fact that whichever government ends up in power later this year, the government and the House of Commons particularly is going to be full of MPs that probably rent, that are probably new, a bit younger, different generation of individuals that may be less tied to this English umbilical cord of ownership at all costs, which has basically underpinned everything from the last 20 years of policy.
I would have thought so. And if I was sitting where Ryan is sitting, well, I'd probably be aware of all sorts of parts of the context that I'm not. But I think, actually, I would be quite optimistic from your perspective, Ryan, as to the fact that the rental sector desperately needs to expand at the moment because nobody can afford to buy a property. Actually, nobody, rents are also very, very high. And with rising interest rates, the buy-to-let sector has been hit inordinately hard. So I would have thought that there were opportunities in the built-to-rent sector. I think whatever happens, renting is going to be much more on the agenda simply because so many people are forced into doing it.
Hmm. How do you see that? Do you recognise that view that people are forced into renting? Are you positive about the potential for change? Are you concerned that Britain still has this obsession with ownership, often at all costs?
Well, I would say in what you guys are talking about, there's a lot to unpack. So maybe there's a few things I'll pick on. I think as a Canadian who's lived here for 25 years, there is certainly a stigma that's unique in the UK. It's not the only place on earth, but I think that there is a perception that owning equals success and renting equals failure in some form of life CV description. And there is also a perception that your home is your best financial asset. And those things are linked, that once you get on the home ownership ladder, that is the key to financial success.
Hmm. But for most of the time that you and I have been alive, other than buying stock in NVIDIA, it probably was your best investment.
Well, so I think that has been true over various long periods of time. It's certainly been true here since the early 90s, as interest rates have gone from mid-teens down to zero. That said, there are some pretty significant moments in time in our lifetimes where that's proven not true. In 2009 and 10, that's proven not true. More recently, that will be proven not true as interest rates have come up again. So I think there's evidence that says, I mean, if you bought a house here any time in the last 5 or 10 years, I'm not sure you've done that great. And that the corollary of that is, if you take what would be your financial contribution to home ownership, which is a deposit, principal payments, maintenance payments on your home, and you took that and you put that into a Vanguard S&P 500 index tracker, you would be more liquid, earn a higher rate of return, and have greater financial flexibility than if you had owned your home on various points in time. Now, I think people aren't financially literate and sophisticated enough to truly understand what that means. If you look at Warren Buffett and think about the power of compounding, no one really truly appreciates that. Einstein talks about that as the eighth wonder of the world, the power of compounding. And so I think that there is a shortcoming in PR, in government understanding of that and communication of that issue. So number one, I'm a big believer that renting has a huge amount of benefits to people that they don't understand. From our perspective, that's really not our mission. We're not proselytizing renting. Our mission is we're like Samsung versus Apple. We think there is a poor level of renting product in the market. That's because most blocks of flats have been developed by homogeneous house builders who have sold most things off plan to foreign investors, which then go back into the rental market by and large, that are managed in an incredibly complicated, unsatisfactory way. And it's been ever thus here. And so what we're really doing is trying to bring a hotel style, branded, service, customer centric approach to those people who predominantly choose to rent, or those people who are renting for the reasons that Anna's talking about. And in either case, through their choice, that we offer them a better combination of product and service. That's really what we are, is we're a consumer product.
And for people that don't know, that was where you cut your teeth in the UK, wasn't it, with hotels?
Yeah, I spent the thick end of a dozen years in the hotel business. We owned 73 hotels all the way around the country. So the Uncle brand comes from a hotel ethos, which is brand standards, brand promises, brand quality. It's the opposite of the press release around wanting to kick people out. Our goal is we want to do everything we can to have people stay and retain those customers, because that's a much better word of mouth and much better endorsement and allows us to grow. So we're now at 14, 15 locations, mostly in London, one in Manchester, we're opening in Leeds. So the goal is growth. And through that, you need to have a decent reputation. That's where we come at it from. We don't, to Anna's point, we're not created as a government agent focused on solving the affordability crisis in the country. We're focused on dealing with the cards that were dealt. So there are lots of unintended consequences in government policy. If you look at the way government has constructed building and development here, the developer, whether that's an office building or a block of flats, pays for some form of all social infrastructure. So social infrastructure has been predominantly outsourced to private development in the form of Section 106, in the form of SIL payments. So you're paying for schools, you're paying for roads, you're paying for some contribution to the tube network. And ultimately, all of that then finds its way back into some form of rent. So in some ways, the developer is just solving for a return that the bank interest rate and the pension fund community of investors requires, and the cost inputs are what's driving that. So if the government turned around tomorrow and said, there's no 106 payment, there's no SIL payment, there's no this, I guarantee you rents would go down, because there would be a race to the bottom on scale and the rate of return for investors wouldn't change. So you'd find investors who would happily accept a lower rented product. So there is a lot of how policy interacts with rents in the dynamic of where housing ends up.
And what, to Anna's question and to the question that many detractors put out there, would help build more cheaper rented housing? So clearly, I mean, your first scheme in London was the Newington Butts site in Elephant. It's a great scheme. It set new standards in the market when you delivered that project. And the reality is it's never going to be viable for you or any other funding player to come and pay for an affordable housing block, something like that. What are the sorts of things that need to happen to deal with some of those social issues?
Well, I think that a lot of housing, if you looked at the average income of somebody who lives in a private build-to-rent scheme or, quite frankly, a buy-to-let scheme, more than you think would fit under what the GLA's definition of affordable housing would be. It just so happens they're not applying to live
definition,
in a Peabody
I think we both
house.
That.
So if you actually look at the Peabody definition of who would qualify for affordable housing, I would ponder that at least 75% of our residents would actually qualify for affordable housing. Mm. They just happen to not apply and live there, and they're living in private housing. But whatever the GLA's definition of, they would tick our box. So let's start with that we're not really appealing to the luxury end of the market.
I'm not asking as uncle, I'm just asking as someone that knows the market. I'm just saying, more generally speaking, what would it take, or what are the policies that are needed to enable more players, be they Uncle, Greystar, Get Living, whoever,
right,
to deliver stuff rented at
a
much cheaper level?
So one of the things that all of us need is a clear set of rules to follow that are reliable and repeatable. And that's what all business likes. I mean, you can go on any business network you like, and what industry needs is reliability, consistency, and clarity. And I would say that in the last 15 to 20 years of the UK, we've probably had the opposite of that. And we've had 30 housing ministers in 30 minutes. So there is no clear roadmap. So for a start, if you knew on any plot of land what you could get in terms of density, how quick it would take you to get it, and how fast that you'd have all of your permissions and the rules around what building standards and quality and safety and all of those measures were, you would have a much greater chance of a huge amount of capital flowing in. Today, I'd argue you probably have the opposite on every one of those fronts. So therefore, that's number one. So I think that's a big bucket. So how do you fast track things? How do you have certainty? How do you price it? And the government would learn very quickly. Either the set of rules we just made don't work for business, and therefore nothing's going to get built. So our choice is don't get anything built or change the rules. So it would become very clear very quickly, which is sort of a version of where we are today, I would say. The other thing is, I think if the government wants to create affordable housing in the same way that it creates hospitals, and if you think about that as a social good, then the government needs to create a program where it takes the lead on creating the environment to do that. Either it pays for it itself through tax receipts, or it creates public-private partnerships to do that. And you see that across lots of other sectors. Yeah. Hospitals and healthcare would be a decent example of where it would do that. So I do think that in order to supercharge and create any of the objectives that government's looking for, it's going to need to either take it on its own balance sheet or create a structured public-private partnership program that has that fast-tracking effect. And then I think the other thing that you look at is land. Everyone talks about the green belt. I think that's a bit of a misnomer, but I do think if you think about the green belt, it's sort of like how maps were drawn 100 years ago. I mean, how you don't go to Google and say, let's expand the green belt, but let's do it where things are green, not where things are brown and dirty and otherwise landfill sites. And let's remap what that looks like. Because actually, I think what you'll find is a ton more sites that are viable to go build that technically today sit in some register called Greenbelt that have nothing to do with that. And so I think, again, words matter, to your point, Anna. I think calling something the Greenbelt creates a mental image that isn't actually aligned with the reality of what sits inside of a lot of that place. And so I think there's lots of things where you're in the world of politics and there's misalignment of interest. So where your job as a local councillor, going back to NIMBYism, is to get elected to get a salary, and you get letters from your local constituency, your motivation to deliver a new housing scheme is pretty low. Why would you do that? You're just going to get voted out of a job in 1 to 3 years' time. So chances are you'll find a way to reject it. We don't really do planning a ton, but we had one site, I remember once, where we had some excess land next to a hotel. We went to develop some townhouses and get planning for that. And it got unanimously rejected. And one of the counselors, we did this whole traffic report. We spent £20,000 and someone stood there with a clicker for 3 weeks and filed this report. And at the planning meeting, the counselor said, I went down there at 9 o'clock this morning. It looked awfully busy to me. So I'm going to say no on the grounds of traffic. True story. And the reality of that is he had a letter from local people who told him they were going to vote him out. So that's what you're dealing with. And until you make those changes, you have 30 boroughs in London. So you have boroughs, how they interact with the GLA, how that interacts with Houses of Parliament, how that interacts with English Heritage, how that interacts with CABE, how that interacts with Building Safety Act. That's a very, very complex supply chain.
The London Fire Brigade, TfL, everybody.
So until you have somebody who has the ability to sit on top of all that for the purposes of accomplishing the end result goal, as opposed to the individual micro goal, it's very, very hard to see what the story is to push things on, which is why I wrote in that article that I thought that Labour's goal seemed pretty fanciful to me. Not because they don't want 1.5 million new homes, but when you take a step back and look at how to deliver it, you need to make a lot of changes that governments have not yet proven they're able to make.
Incidentally, that 1.5 million figure that Labour have quoted is exactly the same as the Tories proposing 300 a year for the next 5 years. And on that point regarding Labour, to what degree do you think anything's going to change? Because in fairness, what Ryan's just described in terms of allocating a level of principles to particular sites, something I agree with and have written about myself recently, but broadly Robert Jenrick's zoning rules that were planned and that were kicked out because the Conservative government lost a few by-elections and decided that that zoning proposal might not win them too many friends. But that's basically what they were proposing, wasn't it?
Yeah, if I come to Labour in a minute, but if I just take a couple of Ryan's points, because I was just itching to respond to that. I don't myself, this is just a personal view, I don't know if it's got any chance of gaining any traction, but I know that it's been echoed by some developers. I don't myself think that developers should be in the business of providing social housing. I just don't think it's going to work. I think Section 106 has been a failure. All of these associated policies, which we've seen since the early 90s, where Section 106 and similar types of arrangements were supposed to provide the affordable housing that we need, have come nowhere near to providing it. And it is never going to be part of the core business of developers and house builders. So I think we should be looking to the planning system, but not in the way that, well, there are calls for land value taxation actually cross-party. I don't know if a specific way
they... It comes and goes every 10
years. It comes and
goes,
but I think the answer has to be found through planning gain.
Maybe, but one point I would disagree with you on is how, I mean, you say that social housing should never be a core part of what these guys do, which is not unreasonable, but I suppose the point is, if you're a big company, take Berkeley Homes, one of the biggest, then they've got the infrastructure to build loads of buildings, right? So it should therefore be really cost effective for them if they're building a huge, big estate of new housing to then tack on a few hundred additional units for rental at a discount. That, to me, you know, as a human, would make some sense. And I think if we were looking at bringing on some of what Ryan's suggesting, giving people more certainty, and you said to developer X, Y, or Z.
I just don't think it's ever going to happen. That's what people have been talking about for the last 20 years. Give developers more certainty. You know, let's have these changes. SIL will do this. It just hasn't happened.
So my observation is, and I've said this many times to various governments, which is governments work in words and developers work in numbers. And so where you end up with this big mismatch is you have policies, which are long documents. It's like having a fight in court over a legal document. And developers want to know what's the math, because ultimately that's what their shareholders and that's what they're building to. So when they say we want certainty, what no government I've seen create is the equivalent of the spreadsheet that just says, plug in this data, it will spit out an answer, that's your answer, do it or don't do it. And that's where zoning actually works because people know what their density is. So they just say, here's the size, here's the plot you're going to get. I know what I'm going to get.
And that's my point.
And that's your planning gain issue, because I agree with you here.
And I'm saying on that, in that instance, Ryan Prince, would you, if the numbers work for you, would you be prepared to say, actually, look, we'll give you 1 in every 5 build-to-rent homes to be allocated for key workers?
You know, I agree with you that I think, I've always said that I think housing is like climate change, right? So there's no one solution. It's not all solar. It's not all wind. It's not all carbon capture. You need all of them working to deliver some version. So here you're going to need private developers delivering affordable housing. You're going to need the government to have its own balance sheet to supplement that. You're going to need streamlined forms of development that says you can either have a credit against the affordable housing and build the extra flat, or you can build it on site yourself. Here's a sliding scale. Here's the math we use. And ultimately, the investor base will decide, can they do it or not? And if they can make it work, you'll see lots of things happen. If they can, the government choose to change your sliding scale so that it works for private capital, or you won't have supply and you'll have that choice. The US is a great example where they are brilliant at creating supply. I mean, if you want the answer where people often, I hear supply is not the answer, you know, you need to look elsewhere. Just look in the States, go to Austin, go to Raleigh, go to all these hot Southern markets and watch what's happened to rents in the last 3 years. I mean, they're flat to down, incentives are up. The reason is supply's up 10%. So when supply's up 10%, guess what? Developers are going to run into problems. So as long as the financial prudence in the banking system is there and equity goes broke, that's an okay strategy. If I was the government, I would say, let developers go broke. As long as the banking system doesn't go broke and the worst thing that happens is it gets resold at a lower price, that just means rents will stabilize themselves. So there are examples where it happens and it works, just doesn't happen to be here.
And then coming back to you, Anna, where do you think Labour Party sits? Are you a party member of any side?
You're not meant to ask me that.
Why not?
Yes, I am a member of the Labour Party, but I'm a bit uncertain. I don't know if they really...
I should be, being working class and Jewish, but I'm not. I'm not a member of any party. I just kind of look like I could be.
I'm a very uncertain member of the Labour Party.
I'm equally ambivalent to all of them. I've got a badge.
I had to change my bank card the other day and the payment didn't go through. And I thought, is that a sign? So that's roughly where I am. But I am broadly a Labour supporter just because they know that people like me will still vote for them at the next election because we have to, because obviously we have to get out this corrupt government. In terms of their housing policies, I'm afraid I do feel quite worried. I haven't seen really many or any signs that they're going to do anything significant. The only thing they keep saying ad nauseum is that they're going to ungum the planning system and build lots more for sale housing. Mm. That just seems to be parroting a Tory line.
Well, they said they were going to solve climate change as well until they U-turned on that a few months ago.
Yeah, it's not going to work. What's really disappointing is that they haven't put any figures for the amount of social housing that needs to be built. And, you know, I completely agree with Ryan. You need plurality. You need a mixed market. You need all sorts of players in the market, including Ryan. But you need an awful lot of low-cost housing to be built because people simply cannot survive in the situation that we are in. And there's been no peep out of Labour on this. So I'm worried.
We had Dan Rodwell on the podcast very recently, leader of the Council for Barking and likely the next Labour MP. He was very animated, had some good ideas. He's not housing minister yet. So
there are some really good people in the Labour Party. And actually, you know, there are some really good ideas. And
what do you think they should do? So if they, I mean, it's not unthinkable they might bring you on as a housing czar. What 3 things should they do to fix the market?
I don't think they're going to be bringing me on as a housing czar.
Well, they might do.
I'd be very happy.
Not be bringing me on.
I'd be very happy to take the role. I think they should pledge to build a lot more social housing. I think that they should look at capturing planning gain. Well, that should interact with planning gain policies.
The revival of the planning gain supplement?
No, not the revival of the planning gain supplement. Something a lot more profound, really, and a lot more structural, more akin...
A land tax.
Closer to that.
It's like some sort of drunken party game. We'll get there in the end.
Well, I mean, I think perhaps collecting large sites for a mix of housing, but including a lot of affordable housing.
We could have used some of the ones that we bought up for HS2, couldn't we?
We could. I mean, we also have a huge amount of public land in this country, particularly in London. I mean, recently...
Hospitals, defence.
Exactly. I've recently been involved with Southwark Council on the creation of a land commission, which they're piloting at the moment, and they're working with all the public landowners in the borough. So themselves, the council, which owns a very large amount of land in Southwark, together with TfL, NHS Estates and the church, you know, there are real opportunities there. It's an ideological thing. You know, if not every decision was made by best value considerations and it was made looking more broadly at the social needs of each borough, I think we'd start to see a different way going forwards. But I'm not convinced from the messages we hear from the top that any of that's going to happen. But lower down, I think there are loads of ideas, lots of really interesting people. So we don't know, do we, what's going to rise to the top when Keir Starmer comes to power. I think we can probably say when.
And Ryan, from some of the things you're hearing on the dinner circuit, where do you feel the world's going to move to under a next government, TBC?
Well, look, I think the good news about where we are as a country is that the choices are much less extreme. And I think that's a very good thing. If we were in a place where our choices were Boris Johnson versus Jeremy Corbyn, that was not a good thing. And if you look where the United States is today, I think they're in a really difficult situation as to what the choices are going to be. And so for me, the starting point is I think you have two sane, honest, straightforward people. You can have your views on their politics and their backgrounds and all that stuff. But the truth is, both of them are sane, decent people. And that we all know there are some good people in any government. So I think as a starting point, that's a good thing for this country. And it's the first time in quite some time that we've seen that dynamic. I think that, unfortunately, housing is a bit of a political football. I agree with Anna that the truth is there's not really a huge will inside of any government I've seen to make any meaningful changes. Probably the largest, most meaningful change was going back to Thatcher and the privatization of council housing. But really, since then, I moved here in 1998. I couldn't tell you a huge number of changes in the dynamics. I think it kind of ekes on. There are various ebbs and flows of incentives and policies that center around subsidies in the form of stamp duty, mortgages, and things of that ilk. And to have substantive change, ironically, is actually pretty doable here because you don't have a state system like you do in the US where there's no real central controls. But I think that
Work out better, though, that you have a more federalized system which allows things to respond?
Well, you can have national control here in a parliamentary system. So if you really wanted to, you could look at how the boroughs function. You could look at what those rules are. You could look at what planning policy is. You could look at viability and write those rules if you have a majority government
or a minority government on side.
Yeah, so, but guidance has very little teeth and substance in the way that it works. It becomes an empty threat of sorts. I mean, I do think ideas that are put around today, which are positive, is the ability to enable developers to fast-track decision-making. So, for example, the idea that says, why should I even have to go to the local council? Because if I'm just going to get messed around and it's going to be a politically motivated thing, I'll just go to the inspectorate and have an appeal. Because ultimately, that's my right anyway. So they're going to evaluate the actual policies. They're judging it based on the rules that the policies are. So I didn't set the policies. I'm just trying to adhere to them. So why don't I just skip that whole charade of the meetings if that's how they're going to behave? And hopefully in time, that's the only way they're going to start to learn how to behave in accordance with the rules that exist. And if you just keep doing that, then you're going to start to get to a behavior where that behavior will change. So I do think there are things government can do in the short term to at least create a route to progress. And hopefully over time, that will start to amend various behaviors. I think London is probably our biggest problem. The truth about house building is once you leave London, it's not that hard to deal with. You know, if you look in Manchester, Howard Bernstein did a wonderful job in developing Manchester. I was there yesterday. There's more cranes, more construction, more residential, very high quality product, not crazy unaffordable in that city. I think Leeds is starting to do the same thing. Birmingham is maybe starting to do the same thing. And then there's leafy places like the Bristols and the Baths of the world that were a little smaller. London is, I think, the crux of the challenge. It's the crux of the jobs. It's the crux of GDP. And there's 32 boroughs that make things incredibly complicated to operate within. And so I do think that there's been this move to the Northern Powerhouse and a look outside of London in the last 5 to 7 years. If it were me in government, it wouldn't be a bad time from a housing policy point of view to start actually re-looking at your backyard and seeing how you're going to restart housing, because every major house builder has pretty much left this market within the last 5 years.
And that's ironic, isn't it? Because that's where demand is most needed. And it was interesting a few months ago, back in February, Anna Minson, when it was announced that the Mayor of London would be dishing out additional subsidies for people that could only make it to 20% affordable, they get top-ups to enable them to go to 40% affordable on schemes, which is basically an acknowledgement that the Mayor of London's 35% affordable policy doesn't work in the current climate. I thought that was actually quite a seismic step, albeit I know from various contacts and clients that they're refusing to extend this to build to rent, which just seems crazy.
You know, I think these debates over X percent affordable going up or going down, and, you know, then you look at all of these schemes where actually there's no affordable housing whatsoever, in a very significant period where no social housing was being built in any schemes in very many boroughs. And I'm just very cynical about all of it. As I said, I don't think this is the way to provide genuinely affordable housing. It just ended up with the farce of financial viability. And I know that that situation has improved a bit in London, although actually it's migrated to other parts of the country. But still, you know, it's crumbs. Compared to what is really needed, it's just a drop in the ocean.
No, I think we'd all agree with that. Bringing things to a close, Ryan Prince, interested by what comes next for Uncle. Again, you've been here now 2 and a bit decades. Uncle's how old now? 9, 10 years?
No, Uncle, we launched in 2017. So it's just over five years old.
A bit younger than that. But you powered through it. And you're pivoting the strategy a little bit, aren't you, in terms of responding to the current market dynamics. How is that looking and how are you reorganizing your pipeline?
I think that in the last year and a half, the economics and viability of new build BTR or rental residential have been pretty non-existent. There are examples that are bespoke to financing or a construction contract that was in place that predated something, so the math just about worked. And so I think you've seen press releases that are almost historic in nature. But the reality is there's been almost no plain vanilla new build BTR announced in London or outside of London much in the last year and a half, 2 years. So for us, that means there's an opportunity potentially to buy existing assets, to reposition them, to do a better job running them. And that's what we're pursuing. The challenge with that is, again, there's not a lot of those. So there's not a lot of scale in that. But where we see it, we just bought a new building before the end of the year, and we're looking at a couple more at the moment. So we'll find things to do here and there, but nothing of any real scale and nothing that's going to help solve any problem because it's not creating new supply. As it pertains to Uncle, the goal for Uncle has always been to create a brand, and that brand, given that there is no housing brand, consumer housing brand in the world, that was really our observation. So to take Uncle outside of the UK may be a next step for us as well.
That's exciting. And to what degree do you think the dynamics are going to change anytime soon? Are we going to get to a place where investors just throw their hands in the air and admit that we're in a new normal and return expectations need to come in a little bit and that development can start? Or is this impasse going to maintain itself for the foreseeable future?
I think it'll be the foreseeable future. Investors don't really think that way because investors are really comparing this against what else they can do with their capital.
Basically,
so they can go buy a government bond for 5%. They can go to another country. They can go buy equities. They can go buy a whole variety of other kinds of assets. I don't think that there's pressure where you're going to see some sort of universe of investors cave and all of a sudden prices will work and math will work. I think either the policy and the economics will change, interest rates will change, construction costs will stabilize. My guess is a variety of those things will change just a bit. And over time, that will be enough to restart some amount of new projects. But there will need to be some kind of macro policy change to create anything like what the governments have stated that they'd like to see.
Well, let's see how that plays out. Anna Minton, what finally would you like to try and capture? Is there anything you've taken away from this conversation that we'll be able to see in your next book?
Well, I agree with Ryan. There needs to be a macro policy change. The situation is so extreme that tinkering around the edges isn't really going to change anything. You know, we need something really systemic and really structural. One area we haven't talked about is monetary policy. Monetary policy is also part of that picture. We have talked about how this is a global crisis, but that's affecting the global picture as well. I mean, we've touched on high interest rates. It's been very helpful to have the chance for the conversation and to talk to Ryan. And were I that housing czar for the day, I would want to envisage this plurality in the market where there would be room for all sorts of players. And honestly, Ryan, you know, your business is not at all one I would have in my firing line. You know, in my firing line are those house builders who are not providing the housing that we need. Also in my firing line are policymakers who have not got anything in their arsenal for providing genuinely affordable housing. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to reach any conclusions or help with any of those answers through the research that I'm doing, but hopefully I'll be able to provide a more global picture of some of the problems, because I think we've got quite a parochial way of looking at issues in this country. So it's also helpful to get your perspective as someone who, you know, you've got that Canadian background as well, which I'm sure has really helped you in your work here in the UK as well.
Now look, I mean, I think there's a social component we haven't talked about today, and maybe we'll save it for another day, but the way that affordable housing here works is very divisive. And the analogy, it's just a more Canadian one, is a bit like when you travel on an airplane. You know, you and I have seats, we're sitting next to each other. You might have bought yours on points and my company might have paid £1,000, but we're both sat next to each other and that's completely invisible. The way that affordable housing works in Canada is the person who lives next to you may be subsidized directly to the landlord by the government, but that's invisible to their neighbor. And therefore, you create these communities of people who are much more mixed in their socioeconomic backgrounds. It's not completely different buildings, it's completely different things. The math may equalize for the landlord so they get to the same place, but it's done in a very, very different way.
So subsidies and mixing things up could
that,
be...
That was the intention 25 years ago, mixed communities where one couldn't tell who lived in what kind of housing. That was the idea when I first started writing about this sort of issue. We've moved a very long way to poor doors now.
Well, look, it's been a fascinating conversation. Look forward, Anna Minton, to seeing next book. And when you've finished evaluating all the problems in delivering housing, you can have a go at railways and energy and greening the grid and hospitals and all of the other stuff that we're failing dismally to build in this country. Ryan Prince, as ever, always lovely to see you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew.
For making the time. And that's Dr. Anna Minton, Ryan Prince, and I'm Dr. Dre, Andrew Teacher. Thank you very much for listening. You can subscribe to Propcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon. Just search Propcast wherever you get your podcast from. Do share this and do get in touch with Anna Minton. You'll be able to find her on the University of East London website, and do get in touch with any of your views. I'm sure she'd love to hear from you, and we look forward to seeing some of the new Uncle developments coming online over the next year or so. But thank you very much, guys. Great to see you. Thanks a lot for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.